Okay, thanks, Kristen. So Kristen asked me to give a non-technical talk. I don't know if it's possible on the subject, but I'll try. Certainly, there shouldn't be any equations. So you heard my talk title. This is work done with a student, an undergraduate at Queen Mary, University of London, where we hail. In fact, this is largely part of our undergraduate thesis work. Okay, so let me start by explaining to you what baroclinic instability is, because some of you may not be familiar with it. It's nothing complicated. Basically, it's a general fluid process that occurs in a rotating stratified fluid with a horizontal temperature gradient. So here's our horizontal. Right? You can imagine the equator is over here if you're thinking of a planet, and one of the poles to your right. Density is decreasing upward because it's stratified. And then because there is a temperature gradient, let's say the planet is getting heated at the equator and more or less cooling off at the pole, there's a temperature gradient poleward, or in the meridional direction, as we say in the lingua. And basically what's going on is, because of the temperature gradient, these are constant lines of densities. And you can imagine taking two fluid elements, A and B, and if you exchange them, right, you'll find that the average or overall potential energy that's available in the system actually decreased. So that's certainly an indication of a possible instability. Basically, what you find is after exchanging, you find that there's a lighter fluid that's lower than at point where the B used to be. So the fluid wants to overturn, right? So that's the general process. Why is this important for planets? Well, this little process can actually tap that energy and feed it into creating certainly zonal or eastward and westward jets, and also more importantly, create large and mesoscale or medium scale sort of continental size scale eddies. Okay, and that's what's responsible for the wonderful weather that we enjoy here, or really bad weather we enjoy elsewhere.
Can I ask something, James?
You can. Please ask questions.
When the way you describe it, I heard it described as a slanted form of convection.
Yeah.
And so the way you describe it, formally you can have convection in a normal rotating medium.
Yeah.
So in fact, in principle, the process you've described does not require rotation. The point is that rotation creates the misalignment. Is that fair?
Yes, I do.
The process that you describe here involves no rotation whatsoever.
Yeah, actually.
Slanting of the isentropes does require rotation.
Okay, so I should have been a tiny bit more clear. Actually, for baroclinic instability to happen, rotation is absolutely required. And that's why it's italicized here, I forget to emphasize. So if you look at exchanging fluids A and C, that doesn't require rotation, because it's literally lighter fluid underlying heavier fluid. But in order for the lines to slant like this, you need some process that keeps it that way in the first place. And the only way that can do that is rotation, the Coriolis acceleration coming from rotation. So without it, fluid will just immediately adjust to neutralize the temperature gradient, but it's the Coriolis force that tries to actually keep that from happening, okay? So you do need rotation there. And more specifically, you need differential rotation, okay? All right. Okay, so just to show you that this is all real and it's not just playing with mathematics, I'll show you two pictures. One seen from the northern hemisphere, and just so we don't get accused of being northern centric, also from the southern hemisphere. In fact, actually the Berkelinic process is more visible down there. But basically, these are the eddies that I'm talking about. This is, you know, roughly mid-latitude, slightly higher. Okay, and same thing happening in the southern hemisphere. So really nice, beautiful one that goes all the way around. Okay, I show you this because in the southern hemisphere, there are no continents that gets in the way. There's no orography. So orography isn't part of the process. You don't need it to have Berkelinic instability. Okay? The importance of the instability comes from the fact that these eddies,
just clarify what the term orography means.
Continent. Topography. Large topography. Okay? These eddies actually are the objects, the structures that actually move or transport heat from down here, which is presumably warmer air, to higher latitudes and vice versa. Right? You can imagine, you can see it simply. If all you have is eastward and westward winds, he would just go back and forth east-west. You need eddies to actually take the heat and put it up there and vice versa. Okay?
What sets this
cable? Oh, good question. These eddies are set by something called the deformation radius, and it's a length scale that basically comes out of the equations. The length scale that comes from balancing essentially rotation and stratification. Yes?
Is this the mechanism that makes Hadley cells, or is that something totally different?
Hadley cells happen down here, so it's a different process altogether. Hadley cells are usually in the equatorial region. In fact, here is the sort of the edge of the Hadley cell, right here. Okay? There's a lot more structure than you actually see here. You just can't see what's going on because there are no tracers like clouds to show you what the fluid is doing. But it's a very complicated thing going on at any instant on here. Yeah? Okay. So now you know that it's real. Question. The question is, is Berkelinic instability a viable mechanism for exoplanets, number one? And number two, if it exists, what's its role in transporting heat and generating turbulence, eddies, on the exoplanets? Right? This is important because temperature structure, which is just another way of saying transportation of heat, and variability, weather or climate variability, which is another way of saying turbulence. An exoplanet is, at least in my opinion, currently not understood at all. Okay, we're just scratching the surface. And we need to understand those two things if we're going to start saying we're going to characterize the planets. Okay, at least their physical properties. I'm not talking about orbital properties, right? So right now, without that, it's just, you know, model testing.
And you include the giant planets as well.
Is giant planet, solar system giant planet?
No. You show us the Earth. Mm-hmm. Our community is looking for the Earth, but you include, when you say we need to understand this, you include the deep atmospheres of giant planets as well.
Yeah, that's why I tried to distinguish for you presence, the unnecessary role of having orography at the bottom. Right. So, you know, as the talk goes, I hope to give you more and more details about exactly what the mechanism is, how it's set up, and what it does. Yeah. But, oh shoot, there are equations on this. It's like having babies. They always creep up. Okay. All right. Well, I only put it up there for people who care about such things. So what are we doing? How are we doing? How are we looking at trying to crack this problem? Well, we use a three-dimensional global general circulation model. It seems to be a buzzword these days, but there's something special about this particular GCM, the general circulation model, and that is it uses a special algorithm. It uses a parallel pseudo-spectral algorithm. So in theory, it's a very, very accurate algorithm. I'll show you what I mean. It's capable of very high resolution, something like, don't worry about the numbers, T341 of 20 means with 20 layers of stratified stacked layers, you can resolve something like in a spectral grid, 1,000 by 2,000 by 1,000 or 1,000 by 500 horizontal grid. That's a spectral grid, not a finite difference grid. So if you want just a quick rule of thumb, this number is equivalent to about 3,400 by 1,700 finite difference grid. That's being very generous. Okay, it's actually much better than that. And then we solve a full primitive equation for the thin atmospheric layer. So that part described by these set of equations is same as what Christian does with his code and what Adam Shulman does with his code. Different than what Ian Dobstixen does with his code. He solves a different set of equation. In this talk, I'm going to just try to give you a flavor for the mechanism. So I'm not going to talk really much about specifics of forcing and dissipation. You don't need it, actually, for the mechanism itself. It complicates things, but the general mechanism, it doesn't matter with the forcing.
Why the F and G in momentum equation are the same as the F and G?
Good question. They're not. No, they're just for, just generic F and G. They're different forcings and dissipation.
Oh, yes, different.
Yeah.
It's a compact notification.
Very compact.
That top F is from
the... Yeah, I didn't feel like putting subscripts.
Okay, different color.
It's a different font. All right, so this is potentially the most complicated slide of all. But I need to tell you this. Otherwise, it would just make no sense. Okay, first of all, there are conditions that we know when you meet it will possibly give you baryclinic instability. These are then necessary conditions. By that mean, if you set it up, instability could happen, but it doesn't have to. Okay? Necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. Okay? And over the years, this is a well-studied, now well-understood process. I guess the three main characters are Charney, Stern, and Podlosky of the famous book Fame. But a whole bunch of other people worked on the problem. So you could potentially add on many, many more acronyms there, letters. But I'll stop with three. And here are the four. Before I do that, I need to explain to you what potential vorticity is. This came up, I think, during the program several times. Potential vorticity is nothing but essentially a continuum or fluid generalization of angular momentum. Okay, and it basically acts like a tracer, albeit an important tracer. It's an active tracer, which means it controls the dynamics, but there is this quantity called potential vorticity, and we're talking about gradients. Y is the latitudinal direction. So typically, there's low potential vorticity at the equator and very high potential vorticity at the pole. Okay, so if you imagine a slab of fluid, and you look at the northward gradient in the northern hemisphere of this thing called potential vorticity, and you plot it, and you find that there is some change of sign of that quantity, then you know there is a possibility of the fluid going very kinetically unstable. Okay, that's what the first bullet says.
This is a Kelvin reflection.
Kelvin reflection. That's more of a barotropic process. It's related, and it will certainly help you. You mean Rayleigh or Kelvin?
Rayleigh,
okay. Yeah, so Rayleigh is definitely a barotropic instability. It's a different kind. It's 2D, if you will, versus 3D, but there are similarities between those things. In fact, if you really want to understand this process before you get into it, you might want to make sure you understand the Rayleigh instability, right? Because the mathematics is very similar. Yeah. Okay. Let me just skip this one for a time being. I'll come back to it. Third one just says that okay, the Modiano gradient, the potential vorticity, is opposite to dUdz. Z is the vertical direction. U is the eastward wind. So if there is a shear in the background flow, right? We're now talking about the meridional shear and vertical shear of these two quantities, potential vorticity and eastward flow, at the upper boundary, right? If the signs of those two things are opposite, we could also go very quickly unstable, and so on for the fourth item. Coming back to the second one, I highlighted that because that's actually the mechanism that's important for the Earth. The Earth weather system is essentially driven because it meets the second bullet item. Okay? On the Earth.
What's Y and Z? Can you
show? Sure. So I had a slide that showed this, but so on the surface, Y goes that way, X goes that way, and Z is coming out, okay? So we call this zonal, meridiano, and altitude, yeah? Direction-wise. Okay, so the dQdY is the same sign as dUdz at the lower boundary, and that's exactly, if you go and measure these things on the Earth, right, that's what you'll find, especially at the mid-latitude. Mid-latitude is 45 degrees or so, right? Okay? And it turns out that's fairly true for exoplanets, even the giant planets as well. So that's something new.
So these criteria have been established and that people use mathematical boundary conditions. We have this integral form and real-time boundary conditions. It's a little bit more difficult to know in a physical system. Right? You just said it applies to giant planets, but there's this issue of picking what's the lower boundary.
So you're
comfortable with this?
Yeah, because the boundaries are very generic in the way the theory describes them. It does not have to be a solid boundary. It never says it needs to be a solid boundary. But you do need a bona fide material surface. Okay, so if there is a stable layer, particularly like on giant planets, say the convection zone, the interface between the convection zone and the radiative zone, that serves as a good material surface, or the tropopause, in fact, on the Earth.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, it doesn't have to be a solid circle.
No, I understand that, but I would think that the radial convective boundary is not a good material surface, because that's precisely where I can have vertical motion.
No, to zeroth order, vertical motions happen below the interface, yeah? So this is, right, and above that, it's just mostly horizontal motion. In fact, I'll show you a plot that coming up in a few slides that makes it pretty clear.
But I'm confused by this, but I can ask you.
Okay, it shouldn't be that confusing. So if you...
No, I understand what you're saying here, but I'm not sure if anywhere is a least insulating for vertical transport, it's just when they reach the closest to the conversion zone. So if anything, I would say, then you go to a more stratified...
No, it's the opposite, actually. So, you know, here's your Icelandic volcano, right? And here's an eruption. You can get lots of spreading vertically under the tropopause, right? So our boundary between the convective and radiative zone. But once it gets up there, it just goes laterally, right? It doesn't go down up and down.
But are you saying that you're free to pitch the lower boundary anywhere as long as you're in a specified medium?
It has to be a very, very stratified.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not very stratified at the bottom here. That was my point. But anyway, we should move on.
It's not stratified down here. It's stratified here. You need a discontinuity, right? In stratification.
Okay.
Is that clear or not clear?
It's always the least stratified just above the convection zone.
It's always least stratified.
The transition from negative and square.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter what happens down here, as long as...
Anyway, Jim, sorry, let's listen.
Okay.
Just make sure, despite the fact this is a global instability, this is global instability.
This is a...
It doesn't matter, it's really robust. This is a thing that we can...
Global meaning it's an integral instability, is that what you mean?
You have to depend on boundary conditions, you can't do that,
you can, it depends on what situation you're looking for. So I'm giving you sort of the...
It's not local instability, it's global.
No, but you can analyze it locally, there's no problem analyzing it locally, so you can do WKB on it. Okay. So what I'm telling you is sort of the most basic form of the instability, but the instability itself has been analyzed many different ways. Yeah, not the way of mathematics of 100 years ago, but slightly more sophisticated. WKB being one, also counter-propagating ways being another. Over-reflection is another way to analyze the situation, okay? So what Krista, what you were mentioning, really, here, what you're seeing is the zonal jet, vertical cross-section, right? So this is the latitude, and this is height, if you will. So as Krista was saying, below here, because these are lines of constant entropy or potential temperature, because these lines are gradually increasing, right? There's lots of vertical motion here. But listen, vertical motion is still small compared to horizontal motion, even down here, right? It still has to satisfy hydrostatic balance, okay? So when you say, there's a vertical movement, we're still talking about something that's 100 or 1,000 times smaller in vertical velocity compared to the horizontal velocity, okay? And then this is the sort of material boundary, if you will, where things don't really cross that much. Then above that, it's absolutely stable in terms of describing it as a radiative zone. Okay. All right, so yeah, I need to tell you the background info. It's not calculation from just one run. It's been a bunch of runs. Most of the pictures I show you are from T40 to L40, so 40 layers and this many grid points over the globe. The vertical domain extends from one bar, the 1,000 millibar, that's the ground, whatever that is, and one millibar. And the important thing is that we increase the resolution for the same problem, everything fixed, right? And check that the answers you get are more or less the same. So we know that the solutions converge. It's not always a trivial matter, right? Often you, especially in numerics, you do a calculation, you see instability, and you go, whoa, I see instability. And then it just turns out the numerics had a problem, right? So you need to check these things very carefully. All right, our fiducial, is there a comment? No? So our fiducial calculation is for runs initialized with typically 500 meters per second eastward, sometimes westward. We, you know, we check a different configuration. We lay down a zonally symmetric jet that makes it all the same, all, you know, all the way around. Yeah? And then what we do is we vary the latitude at which the jet is placed. So in this picture, the latitude, I guess, is around 50, 55 degrees. Here's the jet. So the jet is actually like a cone, right, or a cylinder, I guess, in the zonal direction, if you can picture that. And what we do is just introduce just a tiny perturbation. So you understand the setup. It's set up in such a way that it meets the instability criteria. If you don't do anything to it, nothing happens, because it's still an exact solution, right, to the equation. So you tap it, and then watch what happens, right?
Can I ask the Piaget parameters are like giant
exoplanet-like? Yeah, this is HD 209458B. So for those of you who are already tired, I just gave you the upshot first so you can go to sleep. So here's the summary of the result. Baryclinic instability is present for even exoplanets like HD 209. In fact, it's fairly strong. And we're surprised to find that you can get instabilities occurring even down to pretty low latitudes, down to 5 degrees north. Okay, that's sort of unexpected. Most of these processes are supposed to certainly be strong at mid latitudes on up, but not at the low latitudes. So, you know, you saw the picture of the large eddies and weather on the Earth. So, if this process does occur on hot Jupiters, we're likely to see large-scale vortices in the low latitude regions. Okay, that's what that statement is. It turns out westward jet is baryclinically stable, or at best fairly weak, for flow speeds below 500 meters per second. Okay, and we understand why that happens. That has to do with the effect of the differential rotation, what we call beta. Okay. I may or may not have time to show this, but it can still be unstable by the mechanism that Dong was talking about, by barotropic instability. So there are other ways to get eddies, not just baryclinic. Okay, so not all is lost here.
Can I ask James a sentence in the contradictory, so missing something?
Okay.
Are you implying that you do get baryclinic instabilities if you start with flow speeds larger than 500 meters per second? Because you say you have it, and then you...
So, yeah. So for only for this, the baryclinic instability is kind of weakish, if at all. So if you ramp up the jet to 1,000 meters per second, for example, then you still get baryclinic instability. It has to do with the shear, So if you increase the jet core speed and you keep the speed down below the same, the shear is increasing.
And that's related to the gradient of temperature from the
Gradient of temperature is related to the gradient of the zonal wind by the balance. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you increase the speed at the top, you're increasing the vertical shear. Right. The process that Dong mentioned is a shear in the horizontal direction, not in the vertical. Yeah. Okay. It's a kind of a jargon. Gravis mode means the mode that is the most unstable mode. Okay. So it turns out if you go through the lots of algebra, you know, like pages and pages of crap, and all you get at the end is the fact that maybe the mode 2 or 3 is the most unstable mode. Right? Compare that to about 4 to 6, maybe even 7 for the Earth. Okay, so what that means is I didn't have to do a simulation. You know, if you just go have a piece of paper and somebody came up to you and asked you, okay, the weather system at the mid-latitude on the Earth, how long do I have to wait before it passes and encounter the next storm? Well, it's related to the number of modes. So can everybody see over here? So if you look at the Earth and you look at from pole down, we're really talking about, okay, and this is the latitude line. So eddies look like this. I mean, I'm a crappy drawer, but basically you're seeing these little patterns and it's moving. Yeah. So if you're over here in London, like I am, you can figure out roughly when the next weather system will arrive to you. Okay. So that information is contained in that bullet item. Okay. So for a giant planet, you don't have this many little lobes, that's all. You have 2 or 3. Correspondingly, the growth rate is much smaller, okay? So this is also something new. Meaning, if you thought you can just throw the thing up on the computer and say, okay, I'm gonna look at what the hot Jupiter does, you might miss it because you won't integrate for long enough. And you have to wait longer for the instability to occur.
Okay. Here you're fixing a differential rotation. You're considering one specific value of the differential rotation in the simulation.
Well, the planet rotates with a fixed value, but the latitude, at each latitude, the rotation is felt differently.
The normalization is fixed. Instance.
Yes. Yeah. The Coriolis acceleration is different, right, with latitude.
But if you change that, I guess you could get instability for lower wind speeds by changing.
Yeah, so it's like for a different planet, this may change. So faster rotating planet. Yeah. Then what typically would happen is that the lobes undergo transitions from 2 to 3 to 4 to 5. Right. So as you spin up the planet, as it were. Okay. All right. So, Rich, you're right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just to show you that we're not pulling the wool over your eyes, we make sure we can get the Earth as well. All right, so here's our calculation of the Earth. Shown here is the potential temperature. That's a mouthful. Just think of it as entropy. And on the right column is the relative vorticity, which is just the potential vorticity with the background rotation subtracted out of it, okay? So you can see the wave patterns much more clearly. These are the day numbers, okay? This is in cylindrical equidistant projection. So like equator is down here, North Pole, and the entire longitude from 0 to 360 degrees. If you actually wrapped it around the sphere, this is more or less what you would see. All these things are borne out in the calculation. But remember, the criteria, the growth rates, the Gravis mode wave number are all derived from linear or quasi-linear analysis, right? So you actually don't know what happens if you solve the full equation. Yeah? But nevertheless, it turns out it's not bad. Okay, growth rate you can measure from the calculation. In about 4 days, you can start to see the wiggle, and here's the instability onset. Gravis mode is about 4. You know, I don't know. Here I see 3 wiggles, but it's not so precise. Right? There are pies floating around all over the place. And then if you wait long enough, the whole thing just goes kingdom come, right? And then you indeed, in fact, get turbulence at about 16 days. Okay, so here it is. It's a mechanism that will definitely generate turbulence for you. Okay, and it's a continuous process because the planet is always set up this way, right, for in perpetuity. As long as there's a jet and it's at the particular orbital configuration that it is, it's going to just keep on pumping out the eddies. Okay, so same thing now with the HD209 parameters. Growth rate is now longer. It's about 5 planetary rotations, not Earth days. Right? This is extremely long now because HD209 day is about 3.5 Earth days. Right? Gravis mode is 2, so you get like 2 big wiggles. And turbulence after about 14 rotations, not days. Right, so it's like 3 times longer you have to wait before you start to see turbulence happening. Okay, I won't bore you too much with technical details, but for you know, theorists, you know, they love dispersion diagrams, right? So here's just a one quick snapshot of what's going on. Plotted here is the growth rate. So when I talk about Gravis mode, I'm really talking about the wave number that's the maximum. On the right is the phase wave speed, okay? And the way you read this is where the rate is non-zero is where the instability happened, okay? Where the phase speed does not bifurcate is where the instability happened. Right, so anywhere you see bifurcation means you're okay. You have propagating waves. in between the bifurcation nodes means they're evanescent and there's a chance for instability. Okay. So even though this these lines are plotted as a function of latitude, right, so this is a dispersion diagram you would get, or growth rate curves you would get if you redid the calculation at different latitude. It turns out the profile looks, as you might have expected in hindsight, looks just like rotating the planet faster or slower. Okay, so as you increase the rotation rate, you actually stabilize the planet. Yeah, because you make this curve go inward. In other words, there's a larger or increasing area where the thing is stable. Okay, that's what we mean by that. This you get, you know, you feel great. this is a simple-ish analysis. The analysis is based on looking at multiple layers stratified. So it's an idealized version of fully continuous fluid. When you actually go to the continuous limit, that side starts coming up. Okay, so it turns out, you know, potentially all modes are unstable, more or less, or a very large number of modes are unstable. You just have to wait long enough. And that's the origin, or one of the origins of unpredictability for weather. Okay.
What's the background flow again in this case? The zonal wind and function, what's the latitude dependence on the wind?
So we're doing a thought experiment where we put the jet at 55 degrees.
Okay.
Yeah.
Latitude dependence?
Just so So we're doing a series of experiments where here's our HD29458B, and we put one jet at 55, right? Then we do another case where you put it at lower, and then you keep doing that.
Go 500 meters per second.
Mm-hmm. So everything's same, just the latitude location is moved. But what I'm saying is, that's exactly like as if you fix the location of the jet and spin up the planet, or slow down the planet. Okay? Mathematically, it looks isomorphic. It doesn't make any difference.
I thought you said earlier that if the magnitude dependence of the intensity is important, but that you come into that, you approach your latitude dependent, that enter into the intensity.
The latitude gradient of the planetary vorticity, is that what
you
mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that comes in on this side, on the left-hand side of the curve. So the faster you rotate the planet, this front goes inward. Okay, so you reduce the area where the modes are unstable. Okay, so it does matter. Okay, beta. The meridional gradient of the PV, potential vorticity, is a stabilizing factor. Okay.
U does not enter into that expression.
U does. It goes into potential vorticity in a complicated way.
Yeah. But you said U, you know, when I was asking, well, was asking U a function of latitude?
U, I think it's probably because there's a confusion about the word differential rotation, how it's used in astronomy versus geophysical fluid dynamics, I guess. So even if there's no superimposed wind, just because the planet, even under solid body rotation, there's a gradient of potential vorticity, right? And then on top of that, you can superimpose a jet. So that gives you extra contours of potential vorticity. Now, depending on the sign of the jet, this could be more contours or fewer contours, right? So eastward jet gives you more condensed, constricted contours. Westward jet gives you widened contours. And if this is wide enough, you could actually, the problem is when it's really, really tight, then that could give you instability. If it's too wide, it starts weakening the instability. That's all. Right? That's the meaning of eastward, why there's a dichotomy between eastward jet and westward jet. Right? Because you're actually changing the potential vorticity. I hope that's clear. Okay.
In this analysis, what's the U? How does U, the background, depends on latitude?
U.
This U, yeah.
This U is fixed for all the.
How does it depend on latitude?
It's fixed. It's the same jet, right? You just put it at lower and lower latitude. It's the same jet, same magnitude, same shape, and everything. Okay. You don't like that?
You just told me you did.
Wait, can you show your normal profiles of wind velocities? The blue profile. I think this is red.
Okay, so see this jet?
The peak value is 500.
Yeah, so number of contours is same in every case. All I'm doing is just shifting this down.
But the peak value is 500 and then it goes down away from the core.
Yeah, it's like a cone in flow space. There's definite gradient, right? It goes from low to high. There's a vertical shear. In fact, you need that for the instability. Yeah. Maybe it's a 2D versus 3D issue. Right? Maybe you're thinking in terms of 2D.
I think we should move on.
Okay.
You can come back to the later.
Did you have a question? Yeah? Okay. All right. So, as I said, the results are in fairly good agreement with linear theory. Not surprising, since lots of smart people have done this. But linear theory says, you know, below about 20 degrees, we can't really say anything. In fact, it's probably stable. Okay, and that has to do with a technical thing. But that's basically what the linear theory says. We can't go below a certain critical latitude, right? But if you do a full nonlinear numerical simulation, we don't care, right? So you can always put the jet down anywhere you want. And we see, we in fact find that you can go down as low as about 5 degrees in latitude, and you can still get baryclinic instability. Right, but below that, we, you know, no matter what we do, it's hard to disturb it. Okay. All right. So here it is, demonstration of it. So same jet, and nothing's changed. Okay. All I do is just move it down, move the core of the jet, the center of the jet, down to different latitudes. So at mid latitude is a very clean baryclinic instability. Right, again, this is potential temperature upstairs and vorticity downstairs. 25, now it's starting to look a little bit different, but there's still a very clean instability. Go to 2, you know, there's like, and then nothing happened, right? It does not go unstable. Okay. And what's more, note the day numbers. I'm not saying that absolutely we can rule out baryclinic instability in this case. It may happen, but it may happen so long from now that it may, you know, we can't chase it down, right? But it's really a matter of time scales. So the instability.
I can't do it for more than
3 years. It's a hard calculation.
What? I don't
want
to know. T42 and 40
in rotation. You have to balance it, and it's 40 layers.
Okay, we can talk about this. I'm surprised that it's so difficult.
Well, it's not so difficult. It just takes more resources.
And you know, Adam Schulman and Emily, we've been running like 20, 30, 40 layers for thousands of days. They're not balanced, but for 1,500 days. So there's something there that is.
Yeah, it's a slightly more sophisticated code. It does more things.
Okay. There must be something, yes.
Well, yeah. You can do it, but the weaker the instability, the more accurate your numerics has to be. Mm-hmm. So we try to be very careful with that. In principle, there's no problem going. You know, I mean, Hedar has done calculations that go 200,000 days or whatever. But just because you can doesn't mean you should. Okay. All right. Further diagnostics. So if you, according to the theory, if you look at the vertical cross section, so this is now the longitude, not latitude, longitude and height. So if you look at that and plot the temperature has this very telltale tilt to the west. Okay, so you can work out the algebra, and that shows that the heat is being transported north in the northern hemisphere, and then south in the southern hemisphere. And simultaneously, if that's happening, the stream function also has a telltale corresponding tilt to the east, to the right. So that's how we know heat is actually being properly transported. Note, though, that the tilt is very slight. Okay. In fluids language, we would say the dynamics is very barotropic, actually. Okay. So that might be surprising to a lot of you, that we've been pushing, 3D simulations, yada yada yada, but actually the dynamics is fairly 2D. Okay. In the radiative zone. Let me make that clear. Okay. Let me skip this because you were taking a long time. Now that you know how to read these plots, just a quick show of what's going on with the westward jet. Right? Put it at the same latitude, 55 degrees, same magnitude, 500 meters per second, and it just doesn't go unstable. Right? Except if you look over here in the vorticity picture, there's something happening. Right? It's just not baroclinic instability. It's actually barotropic instability. It's a 2D instability. And by Squire's theorem, if there's a presence of 2D instability, that goes first. That's very quick. And if you look at the this number, which is a Rayleigh criteria, right? Beta minus UYY. According to Rayleigh criterion, if you look at that number and in anywhere in the interior of the fluid that the sign of that quantity changes, then it's possible that the fluid go unstable. And here it is, right? At mid latitude, it does change sign and it does undergo barotropic instability. But if you, as I said, increase the same jet now, but increase the amplitude, the strength of the jet, then you again see clean baroclinic instability. Okay, so this is my last slide. I didn't do so bad. We started late. Okay, so some thinking points. Baroclinic instability is much more possible than we thought. I mean, in the beginning, when we were just like trying to figure out and guess the basic properties of the planet from back of the envelope calculation, the deformation radius, this number that I mentioned before, is quite big. It's the size of the planet almost. And although I erased the picture, I had this picture of the planet looking down, and I said, if you pick a latitude, you'll see baroclinic instability go like that. And this scale, length scale, is about the size of the deformation radius. Okay? So if it's too big, there's no room for the baroclinic instability to go. So it doesn't happen. That's what you would think. Right? But actually, that's too simplistic, because it's not like there's a single mode that goes unstable. It's a spectrum. Right, so you're forgetting about the other mode, right? So it can't happen. Yeah, and not only that, we just saw that it can happen very low latitude, right? Despite what the linear simple theory says. Okay, so given that the instability is viable and apparently fairly robust, how valid is to start our general circulation model calculation from rest, right? Better way to think about it, think about starting the general circulation calculation is to start with eddies, right? Maybe. It's a thinking point. Think about it, right? Okay, so today I only talked about adiabatic conditions, right? No forcing, no dissipation. Of course, we do that because little steps for little feet, right? We want to first understand the simple situation and we can slowly build up physics. So that's being done right now, even as we speak. And let's face it, I put down a really highly idealized condition, a single jet, a real planet has multiple jets. Okay, or very complicated vertical profiles. So the reason why it's important to study that is because, of course, you know, in mathematics we say there's, you always go from n equals 1, 2, 3, and then infinity, right? The reason you do that is because having two things is very different than having just one thing, because they interact with each other. Right? So all this theory you build up from a very simple situation may or may not apply. Right? But it gives you something to think about, a starting point, right? And finally, a point that I really want to drive home, you know, the take-home point, is that we got to start looking at problems at this level if you want to really make serious stab at helping the observers, you know, to take up the Charbonneau challenge, right? As if that was a real challenge. You need to understand the fundamentals to help, you know, help the observers figure out what they're looking at and what to do next. Make sure there are no observers around. Okay. And actually, it's quite interesting, even from a theoretical standpoint, because one thing I hope I got across to you as a theorist is that. Because the conditions are so different on exoplanets compared to, say, the Earth or other solar system planets, even the things that you studied in high school and you thought, oh, I definitely know how it goes, may not be true anymore, right? So you got to chase it down. Look at it and see if it still applies. Surprisingly, some of it does, some of it doesn't. Okay? So that's the end of the talk.
So if you just run CCN, you have to be careful now. Sometimes you don't capture this physics. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah.
What should you do to capture this?
First of all, have a really accurate, really accurate algorithm. Okay, the business of fluids is just fraught with...
So are you accusing Kristen not resolving these things?
Well, as Kristen said, you're doing what, T106 or...
What's the message?
T42. So, like, for these problems, T42 happens to be just on the verge of convergence. Like, if you go below, you get nothing, you get junk. Okay, and even T42, you have to really squint really hard and know what you're doing. But it is because we've done T85 and 106 and T17, even up to T341 for short times, that we know we can put trust in the T42 calculation. But it can be tricky, yes. So resolution, the way you're dissipating the calculation, right, the way you're solving the equation, balance is another issue. It's a technical term, but the problem originates from trying to solve partial differential equations with boundary conditions, and you have to initialize the calculation in a consistent way. You can't just arbitrarily put down initial conditions, because that would almost certainly guarantee that you'll see lots of turbulence, quote unquote, but actually it's nothing. Okay, it looks like turbulence, but it's nothing. You have to print out the spectrum and study, diagnose the field very carefully. Okay, so those are just two, there are many.
So when people run some models for the Earth, as you have done,
mm-hmm.
They start at rest.
They do.
They get the instability, and then they get the turbulence, and they get various things, right? So in a sense, you sort of, your point about how very easy to start simulations at rest is not entirely clear, because you show that starting at rest, you can actually, you didn't start at rest. Okay, so you didn't start at rest, but people do the Earth. starting at rest, and they do get the biokinetic instability. So it's not entirely clear how strong that bond is.
Yeah. So it's not. So when you say some people, you're talking about climate models, essentially.
Well, I'm not very sure about what everything they do, but the head stress test is an example, right?
Yeah.
So you start rest and you do get the biokinetic instability.
Well, you get something. We're not sure exactly what it is. Yeah.
Well, if you reach some quasi-steady state, well, then presumably it's okay.
Well, it's okay if you don't go...
So static condition is forgotten inside.
Yeah, so I would say it's okay if you don't integrate too long, because the errors add up.
Oh,
yeah,
I see.
Okay. And so it's a competing effect. You have to go long, but you don't want to go long because you know the longer you go, the less trustworthy.
But this is where the scheme you use and the initial conditions matter.
Yeah, you have to. So this business of balancing. In mathematical language, we say we locate the slow manifold, right? It's a place in the phase space where the solutions really stay where it's supposed to, you know. It doesn't go off to infinity. Unfortunately, we don't know.
I mean, the point is that if you have a scheme that creates a lot of large errors, after a while you cannot trust when you get the
yeah.
same thing. And also, if you start your initial conditions without satisfying exactly the equations, you can also create noise after a while.
Yes. In fact, even if you did use balance condition, you have no guarantee that this will not happen. Mm-hmm. It's just shown, and from, you know, 50 years of experience, that doing this will delay the onset of funny business.
So how about the various trends that have been done for deep atmospheres? Let's say what Alan Shum has been doing and what Emily has been reproducing with the spectral code as well in a similar setup, they get an equatorial jet.
So are you supposed to ask it in his talk?
No. You're saying that you get the biokinetic instability if you put the jet at latitude, but when you approach the equator, it goes away.
Uh-huh.
So isn't that consistent with the fact that for the equatorial jets, people don't see biokinetic instability, and
yeah.
So therefore you have an agreement there?
Yeah, you might say that, but I think that's being too hopeful. I would just say this can't really address that, you know, particularly because it appears. I think I don't want to give away Hitler's talk, but it appears that, you know, super rotation isn't a robust feature, right? It doesn't always happen. So I think the most fair thing to say there is that we still don't really understand what's responsible for the equatorial jet and equatorial flow in general, actually. I think we need to do more studies.
More questions?
So how did you pick the speeds for the jets that you put in?
That's a very good question. We put it out of our asses. No. essentially, that's what we did. By hand. Of course, you can always, you know, invoke previous general circulation models. They tend to get fairly high winds. Now our group, you know, has generally stood away from supersonic winds. You know, atoms, and in one case at least, you get supersonic winds, but we don't think that's physical. So.
What is the question? The supersonic.
Have you decided what speed jet to put in? Because apparently there's so a 500 meters per second.
What James is saying is that some of the runs that have been produced somewhat differently, they produce like several kilometers per second. And that's supersonic, and that's surprising, and possibly wrong.
Yeah, it's not consistent with the equations being solved, basically. But the numerics doesn't care. It doesn't care what equation you're solving. It does whatever it does. So you know, it's pretty testy in that way. You have to, you know, you have to know when to guide it properly sometimes. When to, you know, when to reprimanded.
Okay. All right.
Okay.